So if you had your lesson for this morning on your mind, as Brian led us through the prayer this morning, Brian hit on several things that we'll talk about today. And I appreciated Brian's thoughtfulness in doing that. Let me tell you what I have in my mind as I teach this class. We need to finish up chapter 3, and then we'll do chapter 4. And when I prepare to teach, I put markers in my notes that say, don't spend more than this much time on this topic, else you'll run out. So I think we'll spend 2 or 3 minutes reviewing chapter 3, the first part. I think that we'll probably spend as much as 20 minutes talking about the rest of chapter 3, and then roughly the last 15 minutes, we'll talk about chapter 4. And I'm really glad that Jacob and Megan walked in, because I've got one set of newlyweds sitting right there, and I got another set of nearlyweds sitting over here, and the very first thing we're going to talk about is the husband-wife relationship. So all of you who are older, y'all need to speak up, and here's your opportunity to give some advice to some young people who are listening. So, by way of review for chapter 3, seek those things above was a theme of chapter 3. Where did we define the things that are above? Yeah, not on the earth. They're not earthly things. Where Christ is. So where Christ is where things that are above. And we talked about not earthly things, and we talked about how earthly there was carnal. It was lasciviousness. It was lewd. It was wanton. And that's what he was driving at. So we should set our mind on things above. And there was a list given of the things that would be representative of that. In verse 10, we're to put on the new man, who is made in the image of him who made him. Note the capital letters. We are a new man in the image of Christ. We are supposed to reflect Christ. And there's that list of attributes in verses 12 through 14 of the characteristics of one who is a disciple of Christ. And we talked at some length about those type things. Verse 17 said, do all in the name of Jesus. So, whether we're at work, we're in school, we're at a Walmart or a Burger King, you know, that the actions and the way we behave, we're representatives of Christ, being the disciples of Christ. So, this morning, we're continuing in a discussion about what do the followers of Christ look like in their relationship with others. So, in looking at that those relationships, we want to consider this in the reflecting on how do disciples reflect Christ in the various roles that are presented at the end of chapter 3, starting in verse 18. Well, there's one way that we could do this. We could do this individually, right? We could say, well, wives are to submit, and husbands are to love, and children are to obey, fathers are not to provoke, servants are to obey, masters are to be fair. And we could break all that down, and I don't know how you could talk about this without doing some of that, so that we can look at the different roles. However, I would like for us to focus this discussion in terms of relationships, because that's the way they're paired in the reading. These go together. Well, wives are to submit and husbands are to love. And then these go together. Children are to obey. Fathers are not to provoke. Servants are to obey. And masters are to be fair. So, as we do our discussion, let's think in those terms. How do these roles interact with each other? how would one persuade the other? And remember, he's talking to disciples. He's talking to people who are disciples of Christ. But, to be fair, these could be one-sided relationships. There might not be disciples on both sides of this relationship. I got a place in my slides for us to talk about that. But first, let's talk about, as Paul is talking to a congregation in Colossae of disciples, how do disciples in each of these roles and their relationships work with each other and support each other? These are in the Lord relationships. And I've got a place in my slides where we're going to talk some about being in the Lord in these relationships. So, those last two bullets are to let you know that I'm getting to it. And if you want to talk about it, I want to talk about it too. But let's get to that point and then we'll talk about it. That makes sense. So, I think I inadvertently erased my key that I always use to remember when to answer the questions, because I think I've gotten just a hair too far. So, let's stop. And, Brother Jim, can we start with you? And, no, wait, I'm sorry. I am confused. We're not going to answer questions. When we get to chapter 4, we're going to answer questions. See, I was wrong in the first place. I shouldn't have second-guessed myself. Okay, back to husbands and wives. I want us to consider the whole of the teaching. And when I say the whole of the teaching, I'm not just talking about Colossians. I'm talking about what does God teach us about the relationships between husbands and wives, or children and fathers, or masters and servants. I think we do an injustice if we just pull a verse out of Colossians and say, that's what we need to be doing if we consider that in, that's the whole of it. I think there's much more to it. So this week I've been spending some time, and I've been trying to see all that I could see about this husband-wife relationship. And I'm not going to put every verse I looked at up here. I've kind of tried to boil it down to, these are the ones that I think will convey the message, give us a better look at it. And if you still got questions, I'm happy to talk with you about it. That made it sound like I'm going to say something shocking. Don't think that. I'm not. I find it to be an interesting topic. But I don't think we can look at just Colossians 3, 18 and 19 and say we've done justice to it. So, one of the things that came to mind is Philippians. We just got finished talking about Philippians, right? And one of the things that we talked about is being of the mind of Christ. How would we reflect Christ because we're the disciples of Christ? And one of the things that was just stood out and we talked a good deal about in chapter 2, 3 through 5, let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interest, but also for the interest of others. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. This is a yes or no question. Is this applicable to the marriage relationship? I see a lot of heads going up and down. It is. If this isn't applied in a marriage, well, we got a bigger issue than how we treat the guy who cuts our yard, right? Which in Lisa's case is me. But, you know, how we treat the guy at Burger King. So we need to have a lowliness in our mind. We need to esteem others better than ourselves. I'm not going to reteach the Philippians class, but we talked about things that where we can be submissive to someone else in their desires and the things that they want to do. It's a sacrificial approach to a relationship. We make sacrifices in what we want, in our selfish nature. your own. Okay. You had that look, you know, like you were all ready to go. By all means, y'all chime in. I'm not trying just to be a lecturer here. I looked at Ephesians 5, 21 through 33. We're not going to take the time to read that here. We'll look at some snippets out of it. But that's a lengthy reading about the relationship between a wife and a husband. One verse in particular, verse 5:21, that unfortunately sometimes the editors of our text will put in the section above. And it's now ignored when talking about the husband and wife relationship. But he starts that section in Ephesians, verse 21, we are submitting to one another in the fear of God. And then he starts talking about the wife's role and the husband's role. Philippians 2, 7 through 8. I pulled this out because it talks about Christ being obedient. We're talking about wives' roles and husbands' roles. We're both supposed to be representatives of Christ. Well, here's what Christ did. He made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant, and coming in the likeness of man and being found in the appearance of a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross. The text says, wives are to submit. What I think we struggle over this with is that our culture has twisted this and said we are demeaning to women, that we are putting women, we're going to put them in their place, right? That women aren't capable. Now, what could be further from the truth? When you think of the Bible as a whole, where would you go to talk about the value of a woman? Now, this is participation. That's on here. Very good. I don't have that on here, but that is a valid, very valid point. What about in the beginning? Genesis 2:18. I will make him a helper comparable to him. That's a role that speaks to a value. To be a helper. To be contributing to the relationship. 1 Timothy 5:14 uses the phrase manage the house. Titus 2 has a similar phrase. I'm going to tell you, I would be horrible at managing the house. There is no doubt in my mind. Pete, you saw my desk. Where's Pete? He's upstairs. I can't. Okay, Philip, you saw my desk. I got junk all over the place. I got to keep up with it, right? You know, and I don't know what to do with this. One day I'm going to figure out what to do with this. I don't want to lose it, but I would not be good at managing the house. Is managing the house, okay, here's y'all's chance to chime in. Is that just like a slam dunk? That's just you, boy, you can just get that done without any trouble whatsoever. Penny's shaking her head no. I mean, it takes a lot of effort. Three meals a day, the laundry gets done, the house is clean. There's a lot that's being done. There's nothing that says that a woman has an inability in any regard. The Bible doesn't teach that. Proverbs 31:10-31, Megan referenced that earlier. And specifically in that, I pulled this one text out. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. such simple language that means so very much in terms of the relationship that a wife brings to the marriage. The submission that's being described here is one like Christ. It is a sacrificial love. It is not what the world, our culture, tells us this passage is teaching. Jeff?
This whole section back in chapter 3 starts with, if you've been raised with Christ, keep seeking the things which are above. He's saying, if you're a Christian, act like one in all these relationships. And how do we know how to act as a Christian? Well, you just did it. We look at Christ. Christ was submissive to God. We don't think he left him.
No, not at all. This passage has been used by the world to inflict more damage on Christianity than most. And it's because it's a twisted view. It's not the right perspective. We go into it with a perspective of seeing it being a sacrificial love. In both sides of the relationship, click. It all makes sense. Because now the woman is being honored in her sacrificial love that she does for her family. I'm fixing to go to husband. Oh, go ahead.
It's also a given role. In 1 Corinthians 11, God is head of Christ. Christ is head of man. Man is head of woman. But as you pointed out in Philippians, Christ did not consider equality with God something to be held on to, but he submitted and took his role as the sacrifice. So because it's a role doesn't mean you're any less of a person or diminished or anything, but it is a role.
You think of a military person who literally gives his life for his country. Do we think less of that person or do we think more of that person? We think more of them because of their sacrifice to something that they loved, their country. I think that's the mindset that we need to bring to this. Andy? Yeah, I use the phrase at our office frequently in meetings, and I say, we've got too many chiefs and not enough Indians. Now, I guess that's not politically correct anymore, but that's... Sorry, Brian. I'm not rushing off, but I'm going to move on if y'all... Okay, so this is a softball question, just to let y'all know. You should be able to answer this pretty easily. We're going to talk about husbands. Husbands are to love in what way? That's not the word I'm looking for, but you're right.
Sacrificially.
The whole setup was, because we're going to see a theme through this, it's sacrificial love that's being described. Ephesians 5:25, husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. The her is the church. Right? So we're disciples of Christ. We're looking like Christ. We're emulating Christ. And so husbands, we're going to be like Christ and we're going to demonstrate sacrificial love. Ephesians 5:29, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourished and cherishes, just as the Lord does the church. Nourish. What comes to mind? You talk about someone being a nourishing, in a nourishing role? Yeah. Nourishment is, we talk about food. We talk about things that we have to survive. And one of the things that husbands need to be is spiritual leaders, spiritual nourishers, to not only put food literally on the table, but to also bring spiritual leadership to the house. It's sacrificial love. Philippians 2:3. This is referencing back to the slide. I didn't put the whole slide back up here, but just to call to mind that esteeming others better than himself role. That idea of the wife is going to be, her needs are going to be put before the husband's needs. Alan. Because it's not a sacrifice if it's a have to. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Husbands and wives. Anything else? All right. I'm a new, and I'm counting you and Pete as newlyweds. Newlyweds and nearlyweds. Any questions? I mean, y'all got it? All right. Look, years from now, I'm going to come back to you and I'm going to go, hey, y'all remember this? Children and fathers. Children are to obey and honor. Honor comes from Ephesians. That phrase is used there in 6:1. So, you got children. We think of children, that's everything from newborns to they're out on their own. Right? Well, not at my house. That 30, almost 30-year-old, 29-year-old, and 26-year-old, they still are considered the children, right? But my question, you know, my thought is the very, very young, if we're teaching them, okay, you need to obey, do they really understand what we're, the concept of obedience? Well, I'm talking, you know, obey in arms. They're hungry. You know, they want to be cleaned up. That's really about all they think about. So at some point, though, there's some ability to reason and understand right from wrong. So my question to you parents who have raised children, all you younger group, go listen up. When do you start? I put when they're very young. Chad trumped me and said before they're born, and he's right. Because in your building of that husband-wife relationship, you're establishing what that house is going to be like, and you're establishing what that child, the environment that that child is going to be reared in. I have the privilege of being able to speak to the fact that I have boys and a girl. So I have both sides of the coin here. And I'll give you just one illustration, and if y'all have others, y'all are willing to chime in. Lisa and I made I remember distinctly having the conversation about how we were going to manage this. Because now we have a girl. And modesty is going to be something that's going to be important in raising a girl. More so than a boy. That doesn't mean men don't have modesty requirements. I'm just thinking a girl will be drawn by society harder than the boys will. And we talked about when do we start dressing this infant modestly? So do you let them wear really short shorts? Do you let them wear clothing that is, you would never think of it being an immodesty issue because of the youth? When do you enforce that rule? If you've let that child start that way, well, they're starting kindergarten. Is that when you start it? Well, they're starting junior high. Because, you know, in junior high, you start getting into they're starting to notice each other a little bit, right? So parents, when do you start? Absolutely. Concerning the modesty question, when do you start dressing your child modestly? It's not a hard question, folks.
When they're very young.
As a parent of a daughter, I've never had Sarah come to me or mom with an outfit and ask us if this would be okay. Because she knows. Because she was raised that way. From being very, very young. You set standards, as Chad pointed out, before they're born. And those standards, as Brother Jim is talking about, will carry with them for a very, very long time. Yes, sir. Hypocrisy detectors. And if you fail in one regard, then you don't look like Christ when you do this. Why do I have to look like Christ in something else? What age does it not apply? I don't know. There's no limit. Right? When we look at Ephesians and it's saying honor your parents, I have a one surviving parent. And I don't think the rule doesn't apply to me anymore in terms of that honoring. But when it's a sacrificial love, then honoring my parent does not become a burden. It's something that we want to do, as Philip talked about earlier. We talked about fathers are not to provoke. I'm going to go through this a little quickly because I've already missed my time marker. Other translations, instead of provoke, say embitter, antagonize, exasperate. I like Ephesians 6:4, where it says, "You fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training." The King James Version says, "Nurture and admonition of the Lord." Have we seen the word nurture already today? So there's a bit of a theme here, right? Fathers have this leadership role to nurture, to provide what the children need. And we already talked about that spiritual requirement that's there. I'll touch on a couple of my side points that I wrote on this piece of paper this morning. In discipline, as a parent, remember that there's a balance between praise and punishment. Both are needed. And if you have an imbalance in it where it's too much praise or it's too much punishment, you're not going to get the results that you want. punishment needs to be consistent. When you have house rules, they're the same rules whether somebody's looking or somebody's not looking. You know, if you're in Walmart and your child's not acting like you want them to, don't tear them up in Walmart, but then when they act the same way that they're at the house and let them get away with it, that's inconsistent. Absolutely. They're the rules of the house. And those rules are governed by what Christ would have us to do. I got this up here. I'll touch on it. Ephesians 6, do not provoke your children to wrath. Sometimes there's a misunderstanding about that. I think we can talk about there's an anger component to it, but I think there's also a sin component to it. When you look back in Ephesians chapter 2, 1 through 3, and then in 5, 6, I think he's talking about disobedience is a component to being a child of wrath. Okay, servants and masters. This runs over into chapter 4, verse 1. Servants are to obey and work to please God. There is a simple explanation for that. We've kind of been the theme of the discussion this morning. As disciples of Christ, we're to look like Christ. So how would Christ have built a cabinet? You know, would the angles be off? Would the corners not quite meet? Would he have to use that large caulk to fill in? That's the way I carpentry. I don't do it like Philip does. It's not good when I do it. Working to please God. If the job was completed in a way that would please God, well, man's going to be thrilled. Is that a fair statement? That if we can do something to the quality that God would be pleased with, then our leader, our people that we work with are going to be happy. The masters are to give what is just and fair, knowing that their master is God. Both are making sacrifices in the relationship. Because a master may say, well, I own him. He is a slave. He will do what I tell him to do for as long as I tell him to do. But that's not a disciple of Christ approach. A disciple of Christ approach would be just and fair. And we've talked about this before, but Philemon is listening to this letter being read. And Onesimus is sitting there. Does this apply to us today? We don't have slaves. We're in this country. We outlawed that a long, long time ago. We are slaves to righteousness. Absolutely. In the man's role, relationships. Go ahead, Brian. Yeah. I should be representing Christ to my manager, to the person who leads the work that we do. I should be doing work that God is pleased with, and my manager is going to be thrilled. Check.
Whenever this discussion comes up, I'm always mindful of Proverbs 22, verse 29. You see a man diligent in business, he'll stand before kings and not before average.
Yeah. If you're just starting your career, this will get you far. Andy. Very good. So, I said we'd come back to this. These phrases also say, in the Lord. Chad talked about how many times Colossians says it. I've added Ephesians in a couple of places. Wives are to submit, but they're to do so in the Lord. Husbands are to love as Christ loved. Children are to obey because that's pleasing to the Lord. Fathers are to train in the Lord. Servants are to obey as to the Lord, fair considering their master in heaven. So, these are all covered by an umbrella of this is done to God. It's service, sacrificial service to God. But the question is, what if it's a one-sided relationship? All bets are off. I don't have to be that husband because my wife's not a member of the church. Is that correct? Right. No. All bets are not off. Your responsibility is the same, no matter if it's a one-sided relationship or not. Does it bring in some additional factors? Certainly. There may be times when something is asked of you that you can't do because it violates the will of God. And you'll have to deal with that. You cannot violate the will of God and still be considered in the Lord in your whatever role you're in. All right. I didn't hit my time markers, but I think it's important, and so subsequently I'm not disappointed that the discussion was had about it. Chapter 4 in 5 minutes. They are told how and what to pray. Again, as representatives of Christ, as disciples of Christ, when you pray, here's what you need to pray about. Earnestly. Not what you need, but also how you need to pray. Well, pray earnestly, vigilantly. Those aren't words that we use every day. How would you describe that type of effort in prayer? Right, Mike. Say it again. The word that comes to my mind is with some energy, with some labor. If I'm doing this vigilantly, if I'm doing this earnestly, then it's not just a trivial activity. It's an important activity that I'm spending some time in. And to be thankful for all that God provides to us, including our spiritual blessings. Then Paul makes a personal request. Now, consider this. Here's a man in prison, house arrest in Rome, and he's going to make a prayer request. What do you think it's going to be for? It's not what I would have asked for. He wants opportunities to teach the lost. He wants opportunities. I'm here, and there are folks here that need to hear the gospel. I want you to pray for that. That the gospel would be spread where I am. Then he goes on to talk about being wise towards unbelievers. And I think he's thinking about how he's teaching the lost when he goes into this section, being wise towards unbelievers. The time is now. Don't let the time slip by. This is when unbelievers need to hear. Show them the same grace that you received. Which, thinking about grace and how we're teaching an unbeliever, is it to prove them wrong? Is it to win the argument? Don't win the argument. Win the soul. Show them the courtesy that was shown to you when you learned about the truth. Let your speech be appealing to them when he says seasoned with salt. You can drive them away. If your opening remarks are to be critical in a overtly critical way, I heard somebody one time say, well, that may be the only time I get to teach the gospel to them. Well, you just guaranteed it's the last time. Billy? Okay? We also need to be ready to give an answer. But Billy talked about having the knowledge to do so. We need to be prepared. I'll run through this last slide quickly. At the end, he gives some individual greetings. He talks about Tychicus and Onesimus. We've talked a lot about how this is Philemon's slave. He's in the audience, most likely because he delivered the letter with the others. These are still with him in Rome. What do these three have in common? They're all Jews. And it's interesting to note that they're all Jews because of all the people that he names that they're with him, helping him. There's a great many that are not Jews that are helping him. Epaphras, who is one from Colossae. Luke is there. Does it surprise you that Luke is there? No, he's documenting Paul's life. He's getting the book of Acts, you know, when he's there. And Demas, what do we know about Demas? No. He left Paul in 2 Timothy. Okay. Sorry to rush at the end. I appreciate the good discussion at the end of chapter 3. Philemon is next week.